This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Crossover Podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What up, Mannix?
So, we're not going to get into them today, but shout out Washington Wizards for good basketball of late. 8-game winning streak, Russell Westbrook playing well. You could say what you want about the teams the Wizards are beating, Howard, but they're right back in the playoff mix after looking like they might be the worst team in the NBA back in January.
Hey, look, coming into the season, I was probably overhyped on the idea of like Beal and Westbrook together. Sure, they won't play any defense as a team, but this team's got some upside. They'll be fun. They'll be explosive. They'll make noise. Maybe they finish seventh or eighth in the playoff. And then like COVID blasted this team as much as any team in the league. Remember, they lost two straight weeks of games in January. They couldn't practice. They couldn't. And it wasn't because I think they had like three guys who actually had it. And everybody else was just contact traced right off of the map. So they were just like, they were obliterated. So like, this is the team that we thought they could be on some level. Not 8 games in a row and that kind of stuff. I'm just saying, like, at a minimum, we always thought they would at least be competitive, fun, respectable. You know, losing Thomas Bryant early in the season didn't help, obviously. They've had other injury issues along the way. So look, I'm happy to see it. And they've made it look, again, and I wrote about it today, credit to the league for the play-in, because if the Wizards did not have that to go for, you know, who knows? Maybe they'd still be going all out, because that's how well Westbrook is wired, and that team, there's pressure on every level, coach, front office, so maybe. But the play-in gave them reason to still chase something, and they are, with everything they've got, and it's fun. We don't usually see this kind of, you know, like, a team that was just, like, left for dead, rattling off 8 in a row to chase a, you know, play in or playoff, whatever, late in the season. This is great. This is great. And I guarantee you, we'll go through all the lists of teams like that, you know, the proverbial team nobody wants to see in the first round. No one wants to see Beal and Westbrook in the first round if you're a top seed. Like, that's not fire you want to play with.
No, it isn't. So shout out Russell Westbrook for playing at that level. Shout out Daniel Gafford for stepping into that role vacated by Thomas Bryant and playing really good basketball. And Scott Brooks for keeping that team together. I mean, you got to give
absolutely.
If you got to tattoo Scott Brooks for, you know, bad rotations or things, whatever you're going to hit him with, you got to give him credit for being able to keep that team together during some pretty rough times there. So good on the Wizards. And Howard, good on you for these Friday podcasts. What else you got coming up this week? We're double dipping in the Crossover Pod.
Yeah, I'm finally going to actually just have one guest instead of two. So we kicked it off, of course, with Tag Team. And then I had Sam Morrell and Stav Halkias last week, comedians, Knicks fans, regaling me with Knicks glory. This week, scaling back just a slight bit. Evan Wash, our friend from Olympic Tower, the NBA. Evan Wash, who, among other things, is the schedule czar for the NBA. People might have seen him quoted in my story today about how the league's rules changes have almost eliminated tanking. And a lot of that's Evan Wash's department. Scheduling also is department. And, of course, this was like one of the weirdest, toughest seasons for the league to schedule. So we'll talk about scheduling. We'll talk about injuries. Are they up? Are they really up? How has this all affected the players? What do we think about how this schedule this year could give the NBA some ideas for how to go, how to change the schedule maybe next season, even when we go back to normal? Do you still want to do the 2-game series in a city to cut down on travel and wear and tear? So, like, we'll get into all, like, this, like, the funky little inside stuff about scheduling, injuries, all that. So that'll be fun.
Very cool. Friday podcast. A reminder, you don't have to subscribe to a new podcast. It's right here on the Crossover feed. You get this one on Tuesdays and get Howard's version of it on Friday. So check that out every single week. You mentioned the Knicks, Howard. So why not jump right back into the New York fray, a place that you're very familiar with. But in a segment that we should probably create a name for, you know, speaking to somebody smarter than us on a topic. I mean, it needs to be a little more, a little briefer than that.
You know, we'll work on it.
We'll workshop it. But along those lines, we're going to bring in now Alan Hahn, who does a great job covering the Knicks for MSG Networks. He does a great job, and a bunch of other things as well, including ESPN Radio. Our old friend from those Knicks press rooms, Alan, we appreciate you joining us. And I want to jump right in here. I want to start with Julius Randle. And it, look, if you don't vote for Julius Randle for most improved, I think you've got some kind of agenda. I mean, he is, I think, clearly the most improved player in the league. The question I have is kind of, how did he get here? And what differences are we seeing in Randle? Last year, he was good. I mean, he averaged right around 20 points per game, mm-hmm. you know, shot 46% from the floor. The three-point shooting is obviously a big difference. But, you know, you watch this team on a daily basis, you know, watching them last year as well. Like, what are the differences you see in Julius Randle?
Well, the numbers aren't hollow anymore, right? Like, that's really the difference, because you're right. His numbers, he's always had good numbers, but it never really led to winning. And so I think really the difference with him has been the fact that it's contributing to winning. Now, how much of that is him just deciding, hey, I want to win this year? I mean, we always say that, contributing to winning, but it obviously takes the situation you're in, the surroundings, the coaching, all that stuff. So I just think for him it's a perfect storm, because he said this. Tom Thibodeau is the right coach for him. He's one of these guys that wants to be coached hard, that wants to be coached tough, that he needs that. And I also think something very subtle that the Knicks did this year, you know, obviously there's a salary cap, but there isn't one on coaching staff. And bringing in Kenny Payne was everything for him. That's the guy that had him as an 18-year-old at Kentucky. They got back to their pregame routines. You know, he's the one that decided to be in the best shape of his life, so he's not tired late in games, that he can get up and down the floor, they can carry these big minutes. That and the three-point shooting. The fact that he shoots over 40% from three, and it's like a legit 40%, it's not like, well, he only takes one or two a game. Like, he's making threes on a regular basis like some of the best shooters in the game are making. So it's just for him, it's all come together for him now at this point in his career, and it's the hard work paying off. And it's really, it is absolutely a credit to him, but you have to also include the fact that he's in an environment that has allowed this to come to fruition as a winning environment for him.
See, now, and the thing that I look at is that, you know, okay, he's the same basic player, right? This is a much better version of that player, but it's not just the three-point shooting, which is a huge leap, the kind of leap we rarely even see with a guy in his seventh year, but his passing too, his playmaking, like the ball's in his hands a ton, and it's not just black hole Julius Randle that we saw at times in New Orleans or maybe early in his career right. in LA. So like these are, whether it's coaching, whether it's conscious decision on his part, this is just a more well-rounded, refined winning version. It's not just, oh, numbers sometimes contribute to winning and sometimes they don't. It's not an accident. Like he's doing more to foster that. Like, where do you think that element comes from? Being self-aware enough that like, you know what, it's not just about me scoring.
Yeah, yeah, he's not in the blender, you know, and turning the ball over on spin dribbles, which was only a year ago. I mean, I know it sounds trite, Howard. It really is film study. It's that. It's a system where they made him the engine of the offense. It's him admitting. I thought, you know, him admitting in the Players Tribune article he talked that he wrote back in a couple months ago before All-Star, where he said, I watched myself, and it's not the player I wanted to be. And he got to watching film. They watch film regularly. Of course, you know, that's what Tibbs does. He's all about film. And he's embracing it. So he also knows where his teammates are supposed to be. And then you credit that part of it, which in the second half of the season, like what blows my mind, guys, is the Knicks don't have any shooters on their team. Let's be honest, right? They don't have a team where you're like, oh, those guys are shooters. They're not shooters, but they're makers. They're guys that Reggie Bullock and you know, who's known as a three-point shooter, but not a great one. He's become amazing. Why? Because he's always in the passing angle. And Julius always sees him nearby. And that's coaching. That's system. That's what they're setting up. You get into the eye of the passer, and Julius, to his credit, knows where everybody's supposed to be. And so I do think that contributes it. Can't we sometimes just have a player who matured? And literally, I think that's really what this is. This is a guy who always had talent, who always had great potential, but realized it because he matured. Now, he wasn't immature. I'm not trying to suggest he was like a, you know, immature kid, bad guy. It's just, I think maturity comes about to a point where you just realize, like, you know what? I got to put in the work. And if I do, it'll pay off. And it did. I mean, is it Chauncey Billups-like? Is it something like that? Like, because I can't find another player that this late in his career has made such a dramatic change in the type of player he's become.
No, Chauncey is a good comparison, because it took Chauncey, you know, what, three or four teams before he kind of settled into a situation that worked, and he, you know, figured his game out. Alan, I'm old enough to remember a time when Tom Thibodeau was a questionable choice as the Knicks head coach, when people were skeptical of bringing Thibodeau. It's kind of looked at as almost the CAA pipeline. You know, Leon Rose hires Tom Thibodeau, his former client. But, I mean, Tibbs is right up there with Monty Williams and Quinn Snyder as the front runners for Coach of the Year. I mean, where do you see his biggest impact? I mean, what's impressed you the most about, you know, the job Tom Thibodeau has done?
Well, first of all, Tom Thibodeau is the coach. You know, I'll say this is the team New York didn't know it needed. You know, Julius Randle's the star they didn't know they wanted. And Thibodeau is the coach they didn't know they wanted also, because it's the same thing. It was that, oh, he's going to run guys into the ground. His way doesn't work anymore. And as
Which is always, by the way, that's always been one of the most misleading things about Tibbs. Yes, he does play guys heavy minutes during games, but he's not a grinded out guy at practice. He's never been that guy that runs 4-hour practice. Stan Van Gundy was that guy. I don't know that Tibbs
still
was that guy.
He still is, by the way.
Stan is that guy.
But yeah, I think you're right about that part of it too. But a lot of the players will also tell you, especially guys that know him and Derek Rose and Taj Gibson, they do admit, though, he's different. And Tibbs has said that year off he took, he went around the league and he started also to kind of look inside himself and maybe I need to change my ways a little bit. And he has done that. And they said he's a different guy, smiles more, which is hard to believe. But, you know, I just think the defensive foundation is everything, right? Because you don't have to have a lot of talent to be a good defensive team. The buy-in's the hardest part, especially in today's NBA, especially when you have a young team, which he does. It's a young team. But every guy I've talked to, and I've done interviews, I've done events with guys like even Emmanuel Quickley, Obi Toppin, like those young guys, they love him. They absolutely love him. They trust him. They believe in him. And it starts with, of course, the star. The buy-in from the star, the lead guy, everybody else follows. So that is why it's not so bad sometimes to hire people you know. Oh, CAA connection. Oh, Leon's hiring a guy he knows. Well, sometimes that's the right thing to do because there's a trust already built in that, as we know, Tom didn't have that in Chicago, and it didn't really work out for him when he had all the power in Minnesota. So all he wants is a say. He's got it. He's got the trust of people. He's got a coaching staff that he got his guys in, but they also added pieces. I just think this was the situation that he's rejuvenated, but I go back to the defensive foundation. That's the foundation of the success of this team starts there. And, you know, that's not something you've been able to say about the Knicks since, of course, the 90s.
Well, it's funny, Alan, because this actually echoes what you were just saying about Julius Randle. Can't a guy just mature? Again, not that Tom Thibodeau was immature. But no, Randle, still 7 years in, could learn to be a better version. Tom Thibodeau has learned to be a better version of himself. Like, yes, he had success as a lead assistant in Boston and success as the head coach in Chicago. He did stumble on multiple levels in Minnesota. Like, this doesn't erase that. He took the year off and did what a lot of coaches do, made the rounds, picked up some new ideas, came back a slightly different version. That's fine too. It's a good thing. So three things about this team, Alan, and the thing I keep saying about this Knicks team, similar to like the Phoenix Suns, the best thing about the NBA, and especially a season like this, is it's always the stuff you can't see coming. You throw three superstars together and they go and they contend for a championship. Okay, it can be fun, but mostly if you're a fan of that team or just a fan of good basketball. We need suspense. We need surprises. We need to be, like, delighted sometimes. And that's what the Knicks have done. You couldn't see this coming. Not even the most Pollyannish Knicks fans predicted this. And so there are three things that are the biggest surprise. Number four defense in the league. Like, it was in January, it was like, oh, that's nice. Now it's like, no. This is real, and it's legit, and it's sustained. The defense is fourth in the league. Randle took this big leap to where he's now under All-NBA consideration. And then R.J. Barrett. What rank those most to least or least to most surprising? And then because we've covered the other things to an extent, give me your sense of like what Barrett's leap was.
Yeah. Can I add one too? Because being top five in 3-point shooting blows my mind right now, this late in the season. Absolutely blows my mind. And that's been a huge part of their winning streak going into tonight's game. Power ranking them though, I would probably say the most surprising has to be Julius Randle. Because I'm one of those guys, and I had to go into the confessional, and I did it early in the season. I was the guy that's like, all right, well, they just drafted Obi Toppin. That's the replacement. He's the National Player of the Year. Julius Randle, get his usual 20-8 out of him and then trade him by March, and let's move on, right? Like, that's all I was thinking. Let's hope he has a good season so he has value. And once we got to about January, I'm like, maybe you don't want to trade this guy. You know. And then now you're like, wait a minute, you might have a foundational piece. So, you know, no one saw that coming. He even admitted that he had to make changes. So it's not like we underestimated him. I think he just changed everything about him and his and the perspective about it. So that's the most important. Number two, I would say, would be the defense. Just being that, and you say number four, that's defensive rating, of course. I'm looking at scoring defense, you know, field goal defense, three-point defense. That's all number one, and that's a big part of this too. Even though they play a slow pace, still, they make you work for every shot. Because, by the way, guys, they're not even top 10 in steals. They're not top 10 in forcing turnovers. They're not top 10 in blocks. So they're not doing things defensively that stop you. They're just making you uncomfortable when you shoot the basketball. That's real defense. So that also, to me, seeing a group like this thrive so much on defense. So that's two. Three is Barrett, because I always liked him. And Barrett is a guy that, and I'll expand on Barrett a little bit. Barrett's a guy that was so underestimated in that draft because he wasn't Zion. And remember I told you, so Julius is the star the Knicks fans didn't know they needed. Thibodeau is the coach the Knicks fans didn't know they needed. And R.J. Barrett is actually the young guy you didn't know you needed because they're all consolation prizes, by the way, right? All of them. And yet they've turned out to be the most significant, lovable team they've had in 8 years, maybe more, because not everybody loved that Melo team. So Barrett is that guy that just cool under pressure throughout his whole life as a basketball player at Scholastic in college. He's always been one of the best players of his class and yet never got all the recognition because he's not an exciting player. He doesn't do anything dynamic. But yet every night he'll start out 1 for 8. Some guys go in the tank. He's 20. He doesn't do that. He goes 1 for 8. He just keeps playing hard. He already has 7 rebounds. Then later in the game, there's this little pocket of the game where he gets a matchup he wants. He gets a couple of easy baskets. He gets to the basket. He can score. He gets to the free throw line. Next thing you know, he's making 3 threes. And I'm hearing from Drew Hanlon going, see his balance? See his set? I've been working with him. You know, like so you just start to see the evolution of a player who just doesn't let bad play bother him. And that's uncanny for a young player because we forget that he was born in 2000. We were all covering the league back then. And he was born then. It blows my mind. But so I think RJ is a story that's, of course, underrated with this group. And he's a very important piece of what they're building going forward.
You get those texts from Drew Hanlon. I mean, when Jason Tatum goes for 40, I get the same ones. And somebody down in D.C., David Aldridge might be getting them for Bradley Beal when he goes up for 40-plus.
But good for him, texting. Though. Good for him because no Knicks fans kill him on Twitter when RJ has him, you know, misses 2 shots in a row. So.
Last question for me, Alan. Anything that happens in the playoffs is gravy for this season. It's icing on the cake. But, I mean, what does this team need now? As you start to think about, you know, what's the next step? I mean, whether it's this season or beyond, what's the next thing this team needs if Randall's now a core piece, if R.J. Barrett's now a core piece, if you got the coaching situation settled down for the first time in like a generation, what's the next piece this team needs to take that next step?
Yeah, it's easy. And it used to feel like it was the main piece, and now it feels like, and I hate to say it like this, but it sounds weird, it might be a final piece. It's been a piece they've been chasing forever. It's like the Jets on a quarterback. They need a point guard. You know, they don't have a legit starting point guard. Elfrid Payton is just playing, but he's not really a legit starting point. And in fact, he's become a net negative when he's out there. Derrick Rose is really their main point guard. He just doesn't start. He can't carry big minutes. So if they can find that piece, which has been the eternal search since forever, I think that changes everything. And I mean a legit get into the paint, score kind of point guard. Organizer can, you know, late in games, that's a major problem for this team at times, especially against good defense where they just can't get organized. They get bad possessions. And in a playoff series against good teams, that's going to cost them, of course. That'll be their weakness, is their inability to get good possessions in crunch time. If they can find one, and they're hard to find, as we know, and it's got to be the right guy because it's Tom Thibodeau, then, you know, they suddenly can transform into a serious contender, I dare say, if things stay the same.
So last one for me. They're right now, as we speak, slotted in that 4-5 range where they'd have a good chance of winning their first round game, and then you got to deal with the big boys in round two. There's still the possibility, though, just they're not that far out from the play-in slots. They could still have to find a way to play in, be 7th or 8th, and now you're dealing with the Nets or Sixers or Bucks possibly right off the top.
Yeah.
What do you think so far of where they stack? I mean, we are getting way ahead of ourselves for a team that wasn't even expected to make the playoffs, much less, oh, now we're talking about second round. Now we're talking about, but hey, look.
We don't do that never. In New York. Yeah, what are you talking about, Howard?
But that's the fun of this is like the possibilities now seem higher. Like, I think Knicks fans will actually be disappointed if they lost in the first round or if they didn't at least make the second round. And I think everything, like, there is no downside for anything that happens from this day on in this season. It doesn't matter. They've established themselves, they've established their credibility, and that they should be a destination, considered a destination again. So they're fine regardless. But just for fun, Alan, if it comes down to it, like, do they have a shot against one of those teams at the top? Do you think that they're suited to, or at least pushed one of those to their limits?
No, I don't think the top three seeds. You can see how they matched up against them in the regular season. I don't think they have a win.
The maybe 2-1 against the Bucks.
Yeah, they have a win against the Bucks.
Yeah.
They have the one win against the Bucks where, if I'm not mistaken, four of the five starters didn't play in that game. So not quite the Bucks, the JV. And I'm a realist on that one. Technically, they are actually closer, though, to third than they are to seventh, which is hard to believe but true. It's amazing. Four games out of the loss column going into tonight behind the Bucks, who just keep losing games that they shouldn't be losing. But, yes, I understand. There is sort of this feeling of let's get greedy, right? Oh, wait, you're the fourth seed. Well, hang on to the fourth seed. Guys, there's a 6-game West Coast trip coming up after Wednesday. Which, as we know, it's like the march of death. I mean, you're playing Denver in Denver. You're playing both L.A. teams. You've got Memphis off a back-to-back when you come from Houston to Memphis, which is not easy the way Memphis plays. That's a hard-playing team. So, you know, I mean, then you play Phoenix as well, who's obviously playing great. That's a rough trip. I mean, what are you hoping to get out of that trip? And then you come home, and then you have like three – they feel like must-win home games with – Charlotte and Boston, your last two, which could be preceding, especially Boston. So there's still a lot of work to be done, but I'm feeling like, you know, house money is anything. Is if you could stay four through six, that's great. It used to feel like, hey, just get in the 7-10, anything can happen. But now, yes, Howard, you're right. Now there's this feeling of you really need to stay in the top six and actually have a playoff series. And I feel like even a first round with a gentleman's sweep would be a more successful season than the Nets losing in the finals, right? Because in New York, I bet you it'll be looked at that way because of everything you said. The expectations are much different.
I agree.
But they got to get there first.
Yeah, no question. Alan, we appreciated this trip down the memory lane to the Knicks press room circa 2010. We will get you a nice soft pretzel on your way out and some chips, whatever's right. Left over in there. But we appreciate it, man. Keep up the great work. That's always the case. But
yeah, it's great to catch up with you guys. Thanks.
All right, Howard, let's get into a couple other topics before we take some questions from the good folks over on social media. Up in the Pacific Northwest, some big-time problems in Portland. The Blazers, they've lost 5 games in a row, sinking in the Western Conference playoff standings. There are a lot of reasons for it. The defense has been horrifyingly bad for the entire season. Yusuf Nurkic has not been very good. Carmelo Anthony has not been very good. Derek Jones Jr. has not been very good. But I think one of the biggest things you can look at with the Blazers, and our friend Jason Quick with The Athletic articulated this week, Damian Lillard isn't healthy. And when Damian Lillard is not healthy and he's not playing at the level we're used to seeing Lillard play, not a lot goes right for the Blazers. And that's a team with a very thin margin for error. They're not good defensively, and they've got to outscore people. So if Lillard is inconsistent, if he's inefficient, that is a big-time problem. So let me start there. What do you make of the problems in Portland right now?
Yeah, it's such a weird thing, and it's tough to see too, Chris, because think about this. The season started with they've got Nurkic back, right? They've got Zach Collins back. They've got their full complement finally. CJ McCollum's playing out of his mind to start the year. We're talking about him for All-Star at minimum, right? And then, you know, everybody goes down again. McCollum, Nurkic, you know, Collins obviously went out pretty early. But you lose 3/5 of your starting lineup, and then that spawns this whole other version of the Blazers where Dame Lillard's just playing out of his mind. Not that we haven't seen it before, but he's had to carry this team for 2-3 months of this season. And it's been fun for all of us to watch. It's been fun for Blazers fans. It's been fun for Dame Lillard, I'm sure, where he, you know, every game, if they're within 10 points in the last 2 minutes, he might just steal the game. And he's been amazing. And he's given us so many highlights this year. But you worry about the wear and tear when it's all on one guy's shoulders. And that's what we're seeing now. So you referenced Jason Quick from The Athletic. Dame tells him on Sunday, this is, quote, the worst year physically he's endured in his entire career. An abdominal injury that happened, I think, early in the season in January. Both knees multiple times, knee-to-knee bangs that he's had. A hand injury along the way. Knee again. Like, it's been brutal. And besides that, you learn to win one way where it's like, okay, Dame's got to take it all on. But then you get guys back. And you think, well, you should be better now, but you have to settle your offense now. You got to figure out how you're going to play with a full complement again. So I think that maybe there's some of that too. But you're right, Chris. Like you flagged it right off the bat. Defense. Like this team has firepower. They've always had firepower when that backcourt's been healthy, and those guys have been together for a long time now. I was looking back through this. So they're 29th in defensive rating right now. They were 27th last year, 16th the year before. So, at least middle of the pack. 6th in 2017-18. That was the year they had Al-Farouq Aminu, Evan Turner, Mo Harkless, Ed Davis. So, like, their wings and their front court, like, they just had more stout defense then. And ever since they lost all those guys, it's been, just stepping backward. But before that season, 22nd, 19th. So they've had one top 10 finish in defensive efficiency in the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, whatever years. Terry Stotts does preach defense. Like that's certainly, I don't think it's a Terry Stotts thing. I don't think they've had the personnel. They do have an undersized backcourt. They haven't had enough up front. I don't know where to begin there, Chris, but defense is a huge issue and a bigger one when your superstar MVP candidate who generates all of your offense is now beat to hell.
I want to know, Howard, what he's doing out there. Like, Damian Lillard wants to play. I get that. He's as competitive as they get in the NBA. But sometimes you have to save a star from himself. And you can say, well, they're trying to compete for a playoff spot. You take Lillard out of the lineup, they'll start losing. They're already losing. Yeah. They're already playing poorly. Like, this is a decision, with the benefit of hindsight, I guess, that they should have made 2 weeks ago and pulled him out of the lineup and said, look, we're going to give you 2-3 weeks off to rest. All those injuries that you mentioned that he told to Jason Quick, give that some time to heal and see if that makes you stronger for the postseason. Because right now, he's not. He's probably 65-70% from the games I've watched of his former self. And you're not beating anybody like that. So it's not too late for Portland, I think, to do the right thing and to sit him down for an extended period of time. Now, is there risk in that? Of course. You could continue to lose and eventually slip like to 10th and wind up in the play-in game, or the play-in tournament. But at this point, resting Damian Lillard is really the only chance in what is a very small pool of chances the Blazers have of doing anything in the playoffs.
Yeah, so I'm just, looking at his splits. His true shooting percentage in January was 65.4%. It was still close to 600 in February, 632 in March. He's at 506 in his true shooting percentage. That combines, two-pointers, three-pointers, and free throws. So, like, he's taken a huge decline in efficiency. Even his free throw shooting, he was in the 90s all season, and he's shooting 80% in April. He's obviously hurting, and it's hurting them. And yeah, look, Chris, that's the toughest thing to do, right? To take your MVP candidate and say, we need to sit you. And like that's especially when, it's not just their standings that are on the line and where they finish in the playoff bracket, play-in versus 1-6 and all that. you know, guys' jobs are probably on the line too, right? Stotts has been there a long time. He's one of the longest tenured coaches in the league. Not saying that he should be on the firing line. I'm not suggesting that at all, but it is the natural thing that comes up when you continually fall short and expectations are high. You know, I just think that that's a really tough bridge to cross for an organization and for a proud player. But you're right, like, especially in hindsight now, you know, take him out, like, I don't know about 2 weeks, but, you know, find him a way to you know, cleverly look, you know, to manipulate the schedule where you see, oh, there's a gap of a couple days here, and then we give him this game and this game off, and we can take him out for a week, but only miss three games or something. That's harder to do this season, obviously, with the compressed schedule, but it certainly looks like it would have been the right choice.
Yeah, and I'm looking now at the Blazers' schedule over the next couple of weeks. They've got a massive road trip that starts Tuesday against Indiana. Indiana, Memphis, Brooklyn, Boston, Atlanta, Cleveland. Really not till the Cavs do you come up with a game that can even resemble a gimme there. So it would take some, you know, intestinal fortitude, for lack of a better phrase, to sit the guy. But yeah. If you're not winning at home, and they had a four-game homestand, Howard. They lost to the Clippers. They lost to Denver. They lost two straight games to Memphis. Like, if you're not winning at home, can you expect to win on the road with a banged-up Damian Lillard? I don't see it. I would sit the guy for that entire road trip. I would. I'd sit him down. And if that means you go one in whatever, what did I say it was, five-game road trip or six-game road trip. What if they go 1-5? Okay, but then maybe you get him back for the Laker game on May 7th, and then maybe he's a closer version of himself. I think it's the only way to do it. Like, it's you got to try to get this guy as healthy as possible for the final couple of weeks of the season, and right now he's not near that.
Yeah, in a different season, it would be easier to do, right? Because under, you know, prior to the play-in being installed, and again, I think the play-in is a great thing. I think it has gotten a lot more teams involved. I think it's created some excitement that we wouldn't have had otherwise. But in a normal season, no play-in, you know, you're still taking some risk, right? They're at this point a game and a half up on ninth place. So even in a normal year, you sit a guy for a week or two, you're taking a risk of falling out of the playoff field. But this year, more volatility because seventh doesn't guarantee you anything other than the play-in, where you play the eighth seed first. If you're the seventh seed, they play the eighth seed. If you win, okay, you're seventh. If you lose, now you got to play the winner of ninth, tenth. You lose that, you're out. So there's some risk involved here by losing too much in the standings. But the payoff, as you're kind of alluding to here, is get him to the postseason, whatever that is, the play-in or the playoffs. Get him there healthy, and now at least you've got a puncher's chance to win. But, you know, that's a gamble, man. That's a tough gamble for an organization to make.
I mean, I would agree with you, but if they were winning before this, if they were winning when he's kind of hobbling out there, I'd say sure, but they're losing. They're playing badly, and I don't see what you gain by – they have – on this trip, they play – two sets of three games in four nights. How is a guy going to get better in that type of situation? He's only going to get worse. So I just don't see that. All right, we're going to talk more about the Blazers a little bit later because we got some Blazers questions on social media during the last couple of days. I do want to talk about the Nets, though, Howard, because you watch the Nets on Sunday. Kevin Durant sits out a week, doesn't come into the game till about a quarter of the way through the second quarter. And he just goes out there and just kind of effortlessly throws up a 33-point in 28 minutes, by the way. 33-point, 6-rebound, 4-assist game, 2-for-3 from 3, 7-for-8 from the free throw line, picks up a couple of steals, goes 12-for-21 from the floor. I mean, and that was against Phoenix. Like, Phoenix is a very good team. Yes. Phoenix is a contender in the Western Conference, and they beat the Suns largely because Durant came in and played the way he did. Watching Durant play, did that do anything for you as you assess the Nets' chances to win the Eastern Conference? Did it reinforce a belief that they were the front runner? Did you dismiss it as just a one-off? I mean, how did you view the Nets and Durant's performance?
I mostly view it as Kevin Durant is just like an incredible, incredible athlete. Like, it doesn't matter how much time he misses. Doesn't matter if he blows out his Achilles. It doesn't matter if he goes out with a hamstring or whatever else he can, like, all these bumps and bruises along the way, after coming back from the toughest injury in the NBA, the Achilles, and being off for, you know, a year and a half, whatever, like, every time he steps back on the court, he just destroys people. And it looks so effortless. He makes it look so easy. Nothing throws this guy off of his game. Nothing puts a dent in it. He's incredible. And if he had been playing the entire season, we'd be talking about him as an MVP candidate. But it doesn't change my view of the Nets, Chris, because...
Can I jump in, Howard, one thing about Durant? I mean, Bob Ryan, the Hall of Fame basketball writer of the Boston Globe, tweeted out during that game, said nobody has ever made it look easier than Kevin Durant. Says the game just flows out of him. KD plays at KD's pace, and the ball just goes into the basket. I mean, that's a good way to sum it up. I mean, he just... The game is so effortless to him. It just, like Bob said, just kind of flows through him, and it just makes him such a rare talent in this league.
Well, and of course, worth noting, Bob has seen all of the greatest players, all the greatest scorers in NBA history. So for him say, like, that is a very, very high bar for Kevin Durant to clear, to make this look as effortless as he does, more effortless than probably anybody in the history of the game. But we already knew Kevin Durant was great, and we knew Kyrie was great, and we knew James Harden was great, and we know that in the brief times that they've shared the court, they've flowed pretty well together, and that James Harden has reeled back a lot of his scoring to become their primary playmaker. His usage rate is down by like 10 points from his Houston days. So I don't worry necessarily, Chris, about, will these guys fit? They've been on the court at least long enough to know that they are willing to and able to mesh their games, but it doesn't eliminate these stats. Seven games. They've played seven games together. They've played 186 minutes. That's it. And maybe it won't matter because those guys are all just such friggin' studs that they will just blow teams away in the postseason. That's possible. I'm not saying it can't happen. But I'm going to be skeptical anyway because it's never been done before. You've never thrown three superstars together in mid-January and then had them play. It's seven games so far. Let's give them another seven before the end of the season. 14 games together. Maybe they'll play 16, whatever. And then they try to win a championship. It's never, ever, ever been done. There's not even anything close to that in NBA history. And when you think about, you know, the Heat coming together in 2010 with LeBron and Bosch joining Dwayne Wade in Miami, they start out 9-8. There's panic. Should they fire Spoelstra? Are they going to figure out the distribution, this and that, whatever, how the roles, all that? They still made the finals, but they lost. They lost with three incredible players in their prime. The Nets players are actually older than those three were at that time and have not had a training camp together, have had this compressed season, have barely played. Chris, how can that not matter? Like, everything we know about the NBA, or we think we know as self-proclaimed experts, chemistry, rhythm, you know, experience with each other, are these guys going to make all of those things suddenly not matter? Is that possible?
I think it's possible. There are exceptions to every rule. I remember back in 2008 when the Celtics won a championship, people were surprised at how they kind of broke the mold, where they brought in two new players, new stars in Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen, and were able to mesh almost immediately. It does happen. This would be a radicalized version of that.
Right. You know, those guys had a training camp at least.
They did.
They got the duck boat ride.
They did. And I think the question is going to be, like, are the offensive abilities of Harden, Durant, and Irving so superior that they can beat anybody else? They will have problems defensively. They will have problems at some point chemistry-wise. Those problems probably won't emerge until they get to a conference finals matchup with Philadelphia or Milwaukee or whoever emerges from that mix. But yeah, I think there will be some adversity there they have to deal with. But I tell you what, Howard, I'm betting on the Nets. Like, I'm betting on them being the exception to the rule. I'm betting that at the end of all this, we're going to say, wow, not only did they win a championship, they did it by playing X number of minutes together during the season, X number of games together during the season. I think they're going to be an exception there. All right, I want to jump into some of these social media questions that we got. You can fire away on Twitter. You can follow Howard on Twitter, @HowardBeck, me @SiChrisManix. Let's start with Chicago, Howard. Vinny asks, given the early trade results, should the Bulls be willing to pay Zach LaVine a max extension? What do you think? Max extension for LaVine, or should there be any second thoughts on the part of the Bulls?
All right, so smarter people than you and me, or than you and I, have broken down the decisions to be made here, right? And an extension this summer is unlikely based on cap considerations and what he could make versus what Zach LaVine could make as a free agent in 2022. So I don't think it's going to be an extension anyway. If he goes to 2022 to free agency, I think we're talking about potentially 5 years and $200 million. So averaging $40 million a year, that's rare air, rare territory. You're talking about the best of the best in this league who make that. There's two ways of looking at this. Is he really worth the same amount as, you know, I don't know, name somebody else making $40 million, whoever, LeBron, Chris Paul, whoever. I mean, he hasn't proven that, obviously, with postseason success. His stats are phenomenal right now. There's not the track record behind it in terms of winning. So it would be tough. On the other hand, Chris, it's about market value in this league. It's not about, oh, well, these guys will make $40 million, so if you're making $40 million, you should be as good as them. Like, no, this is your guy, and he's exploded into this version of a star for your team. If you want to keep him, that's what it's going to cost. Because somebody else will probably pay him that. And, you know, it's not a matter of whether or not a guy's quote-unquote worth a certain amount. It's more a matter of if he walks away, what do you have left? Or who are you replacing him with? Is somebody else coming? So I lean toward, yeah, if he wants to take a max extension this summer for the what would average out at more like in the $30, $35 million range, fine, do it. If it goes to 2022, you've got another year to evaluate him. And at that point, you might have to pay him the 5 years, $200 million. I will say this, quick stat though. He's averaging 25, 5, and 5. The only other players doing that are Jokic, Giannis, Kawhi, Steph, and Luka. So, I mean, he's got the worst record of all those guys, but 25, 5, and 5 is not something to sniff at, and he's doing it on better efficiency than in the past, too.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that Zach LaVine is a franchise player on a championship-driven team. I think he's probably better suited as the second option. All that being said, it does feel to me, Howard, that the Bulls, in a way, boxed themselves in on Zach LaVine by making the Vucevic trade.
Because you hate that trade.
I didn't love it. I understood why Chicago did it at the beginning, but... And it's not just as the losses have piled up, but I think it sets a ceiling for them where you can be a playoff team, but I don't think with that group you can be a championship team. Now, you pay Zach LaVine, whether it's this summer or I agree with you, more likely next summer. Yeah, your books are kind of rough for a little while, though they have some flexibility there. But then the year after that, what is it, 2023, Vucevic comes off the books. So then really you're only dealing with Zach LaVine's big contract. So then you can go out and start to make some moves. And I do think having LaVine there makes that team both more marketable for a free agent to sign there and at least gives you the foundation of something. So if it's not Vucevic that helps you get to that next level, you can go out there and maybe acquire somebody else, whether it's using cap space that's made available by Vucevic or using Vucevic himself in the last year of his contract as an expiring deal. So I think one way or the other, Zach LaVine is going to dictate terms to the Chicago Bulls. I think they're going to give him what it is he's looking for, whether it's this summer or the one after.
Well, and the other thing too, Chris, is that to the extent that you are going to try to get back into free agency at some point, and obviously the cap numbers for Vooch and Zach LaVine will take him out of it temporarily at least, to the extent that you're trying to attract guys, period. Like if players and their agents don't see you consistently trying to keep your best players and keep building and keep moving forward, it can impact the way you're viewed. And the Bulls have a long history going all the way back to the end of the Michael Jordan era of having difficulty getting players, of convincing people, of convincing players and their agents that this should be a destination, despite being a big market, despite being a great city, despite their pedigree as Michael Jordan's dynasty, you know, franchise. Like that, it's been difficult for them. So I think they got to be careful on that note too. I mean, look, as a quick reference point, because I pulled it up on Spotrac real quick, guys who are averaging over 40 million, Wall, Harden, Westbrook, Durant, Curry, Chris Paul, LeBron. LeBron's actually got an average of 38. Klay Thompson, and these are averages for their contract, not year by year. Klay Thompson's 37, 38. Anthony Davis, 38. So, like, it is rarefied air. It's hard to put Zach LaVine in that category with most of these guys. But you the Bulls know him best. They got to count on their own ability to know how much more they can get out of him, how many more steps he can take forward, whether he can become a consistently decent defender, all that.
Spotrac sounds like a microsite of the old Heat Index. It's like...
just that's a good call.
It's like Spo is at Nobu in Orange in Coconut Grove.
Either that or it's whether or not he was going to get fired during that 9-8 start in 2010. Spotrac to today...
That stretch needs its own oral history from all the many, many stories I've heard about those couple of months. Couple more here, Howard. Let's go back to the Pacific Northwest, back to Portland. I got a few questions this week about the Blazers' future, specifically when it comes to CJ McCollum. So, you know, if this goes the way it's trending right now, where the Blazers either miss the playoffs or get drubbed out in the first round, is this the year that we see significant changes in Portland, and is McCollum the most likely guy to go?
I mean, like, how many years?
Five at least years of this. It's like CJ got like 2-3 good years in Portland before he was, you know, about to be traded.
We've been doing the CJ McCollum watch for a long time, longer than the Spo track. We've been on McCollum watch, Beal watch. By the way, the people I've been talking to around the league recently, they feel like this time for sure on Beal. Like, this is the summer where it's finally going to happen. So just, you know, bookmark that and come back to it. And if it doesn't happen, people can scream at me later. McCollum and, like, look, you look at the outline of it, McCollum and Lillard. It's the obvious thing, right? Great firepower, but they both are best with the ball in their hands. They've done a lot. They've done really well together. They can both average 25 plus per game. But they're undersized. It's a defensive liability with the two of them together. There was a time when it was like, well, trade McCollum for, you know, whatever, a big wing or a power forward or something. Right now, we unfortunately still have all these what-ifs with this team. Well, what if they actually got a full season with the backcourt plus Zach Collins and Nurkic and Covington, who they just acquired before this season, and, you know, the young guys take another step, Simons takes another step forward, Nasir Little takes another step forward. Like, you can talk yourself into it really easily of, we got to give this group a chance at full strength and full health. But it can feel like fool's gold. If we've literally been asking the question about whether it's time to break up that backcourt for 5 years, at some point, maybe you have to do it. I will say this, and I'll turn this back to you. I looked at this question before our podcast and said, okay, well, let's trade McCollum. Fine. Where are we sending him? Because I looked around, Chris, and I'm like thinking maybe Miami, maybe Dallas, if you're going to keep him in the West. There aren't that many obvious fits to me in terms of both need and the ability to make a deal, you know, in terms of assets.
I would say if Philadelphia fizzles early in the playoffs, that you could potentially visit a trade that would be headlined by McCollum and Ben Simmons. That, to me, is a maybe. Now, McCollum is not the caliber of player that James Harden is. But we know that, you know, there was a discussion there, at least, about Ben Simmons, James Harden swap. If Philadelphia flames out and Simmons doesn't look great doing it, or if it just didn't look like the chemistry between those two guys was working, or if the shooting doesn't hold up for that team, I could see that being visited this offseason. I don't know what it would take to pry Simmons loose. He's still a guy in his mid-20s under contract for, I think, at least the next 4 years. So, you know, it's a tricky deal to make. But that's one I could see Portland potentially getting interested in. And look, when you're talking about dealing CJ McCollum, you can't deal him for expiring contracts and draft picks, not while Damian Lillard is still around. You know, you have to get players that help Damian Lillard win a championship. Otherwise, you're better off trading them both. Because if you're just going to keep Lillard around for his name and to say, we're going to keep you, Dame, you know, for the entirety of your time in the NBA, well, that doesn't do anybody any good. That doesn't do the Blazers any good, just kind of miring in mediocrity. And it certainly doesn't do Lillard any good, who's trying to maximize the final few years of his prime. So, you know, when I think about a McCollum trade, Simmons is really the only name that comes to mind where you could get dollar for dollar type value and shake the team up enough. Like, the Blazers have shooting. Like, they've got enough guys that you know, obviously it would take a dip if McCollum goes, but I kind of like the Lillard Ben Simmons backcourt a lot, because you could take Lillard off the ball a little bit more, and you could have a, you know, you talk about the Blazers being bad defensively, Ben Simmons changes that almost overnight with his versatility in that regard. So that's the only thing that struck me. I think more than anything, Howard, Terry Stotts doesn't survive an early exit. He just doesn't. I mean, we don't advocate for people to get fired, of course, but 9 years on the job there is a long time. And that's not a team that's had a ton of playoff success. And if they wind up getting beat in the first round or worse, I just don't see how that job isn't open in the offseason.
Wouldn't surprise me, because that's the way this league goes. And sure, like, that, you know, coaches expect that. That's the job.
That's not knee-jerk either. Like, that's not knee-jerk, like, you're, but, you know.
But I say that only because, Chris, like, the circumstances for that team, between injuries and roster holes that they've had at times, and, like, I mentioned that group they had when they were actually a decent defensive team, they let those guys go. And they didn't backfill with equally proficient defenders. So, you know, I mean, I think Neil O'Shea and his group have done a great job as a front office, but, you know, whatever their failings are at least as much on them, which is, you know, look, this is almost always the case. And some of it's just been bad luck. Some of it has just been, like, the Nurkic injuries, the Collins injuries, you know, like, a lot's gone on. And they've been, you know, this is a period of the Western Conference where, like, the conference is just stacked at the top. It's been tough. So I don't, if Stotts, you know, takes the fall for that, it's the NBA. It happens. I'm not sure that it's necessarily, like, if we had swapped him out for a different coach over the last 5 years, I don't know that we have a different outcome. So, if the Sixers are going to put Ben Simmons, you know, back out there, I'm still going for the Ben Simmons Bradley Beal swap that I've been, you know, dreaming about for the last 2 years. And I think Beal and Embiid together would be incredible. And I think Ben Simmons gives Washington immediately somebody to build around for their next era.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I think Simmons is going to be a hot property, especially, again, if the Sixers don't get at least to the conference finals, if not further, this year. Let's finish, Howard, with a little bit of a fun one here. We got a tweet from Felix, who asked, who are the best play-by-play and color commentators in the NBA, which is basically asking who is the best broadcast team in the NBA. Now, the caveat to this, Howard, is that we both, when we're swapping emails, both kind of agree that Brooklyn is number one. Like, we love Brooklyn. Iron Eagle, tremendous. Sarah Kustok, excellent. Michael Grady, very below average, but, you know, they survive without him. I always take a shot at Grady. But they're excellent, top to bottom. So we're going to take the Nets out of the conversation here.
By the way, don't forget, they're rolling deep, too, because they also have Ryan Rucco and Richard Jefferson in that rotation. Like, the Nets, like any given night, no matter how much you mix and match all those guys, like, you're guaranteed to be entertained regardless.
Absolutely. I was just going with the core three at the top there, but they have some excellent people that fill in from time to time. Beyond the Nets, give me your favorite duo, or at least combination, of the NBA.
I mean, I got to at least mention, of course, Mike Breen and Clyde on the Knicks broadcast. That's a legendary pairing and many years running and always a lot of fun and informative. Spoiled here in the New York market with both Nets and Knicks broadcast teams. They're the primary broadcast teams, being fantastic. But if we're just clicking through the league pass, and if I were to choose a game based at least in part on, and occasionally I do this, especially when you've got, you know, you can choose either broadcast team, right? But if the Pelicans are playing anybody, I'm probably choosing the Pelicans feed for Joel Myers and Antonio Daniels. Joel's voice is just ridiculous. And by the way, folks, that is Joel's real voice. If you were sitting there at dinner and you're talking about, you know, the wine selection, Joel's really big on the wine selection, by the way, and I recommend taking whatever his advice is on the wine selection. He's still got that voice, that baritone, that gravitas, that just like everything sounds better when Joel says it. And Antonio Daniels, as a former player, like, first of all, like, there's the knowledge of having been a player and on some really good teams in San Antonio and other places, but there's like a great energy there too. Like, he's not just going through the motions of it. Antonio Daniels gets excited, he gets mad, he's expressive, but not in a homer way. And so, like, I appreciate that. Like, it, like, I don't want to, like, I saw the Twitter question, Chris, I initially cringed a little because, like, I don't want to, like pick favorites, right? There are a lot of team broadcasters that are just way too much apologists for their franchises. They're crying about refs and they're very homerish. Like, some of them are still fun, but like that turns it off for me. I think with Joel and Antonio, like, I never have those cringe factors. Like, they're fun and they're informative and they keep it going and they keep the energy level up. That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Joel and Antonio are excellent. I'd also like to say I love the guys in Boston. Mike Gorman is an absolute legend. I think Brian Scalabrine has been excellent taking the enormous shoes that were left by the late Tommy Heinsohn. But everybody knows I'm from Boston, so I'm not going to mention them there. I kind of like Memphis. I like when I watch Grizzlies games, Pete Pranica, Brevin Knight. Yeah. They're really good. I just, you know, it's in. Oftentimes, to your point earlier, it's like it's understated. It's not, you know, some out of control stuff all the time, which I don't love. I feel like I learned something, you know, listening to Pete and Brevin, and that's kind of what I'm looking for in these broadcasts. Not I don't need like Gus Johnson-esque qualities. No disrespect to Gus Johnson, but I don't need that. I love Gus, but I don't need that. I need kind of, if I'm going to watch a 48-minute game, I kind of want to learn something about the franchise or learn something about the team they're playing, and I feel like those two guys are often really prepared for each broadcast.
Yeah, no doubt. Brevin Knight bringing that Stanford education to the broadcast too. So shout out to my Northern California Bay Area roots. But no, like that's an important part of it too. And on some broadcasts, you don't get that. You might get like a lot of, you know, enthusiasm and everything else. But if they're not at least some point stepping back and saying, listen, the last five games, we've had a real difficult time when we've been presented with this kind of defensive look, and I like the way the guys attacked this because, you know, like if they're not busting out, like not literally, but busting out the telestrator and giving you some sense of like why they're successful in a given context or why they're struggling, like you need that. And not all of them are giving you that. Some of them, it feels like, are there just to cheer. And those are the broadcasts I try to avoid.
I agree. I'm with you. All right, Howard. Always good to talk to you. Friday's episode will be up. Looking forward to that. And you and I will do this again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.